from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Was Julia Child a spy? Find out today on the show. What chilies are telling us about global warming. I'll tell you how to cure meat at home. Jonathan Gold takes us to the best restaurant in the world. Growing tomatoes in Southern California, and we'll find out which is the best new restaurant in L.A. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery, who's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a look at what's fresh and in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. As summer gets hotter and better, we're looking at a lot of wonderful new items here at the farmers market, one of which are figs. And figs are a very fickle product. They're difficult to find. Apparently, they're very difficult to grow. But Evan Funke is here. He's the executive chef at Rustic Canyon. And he is very excited about the figs from a couple of different vendors. So, Evan, explain to us what the colors and flavors are of these figs, and then tell us what you're going to be doing with them.
First of all, I absolutely love figs. The applications are endless. A few of the varieties at the market today are Black Mission, Green Adriatic, and the White Kadotas from Murray Family Farms.
Okay, so a lot of people think of a fig as something dried or in a box there at the store. These are fresh figs. They're very seasonal, and they range in size, in firmness. They have so many variations.
Absolutely.
So it's really a matter of I guess just taking your chances, but then knowing what to do with them, too.
Absolutely. Right now, I'm using the Green Adriatics from Polito Farms with branzino, roasted artichokes, black olives, and roasted fennel, which is absolutely fantastic. A little saba. And then another application would be just some goat cheese, a little bit of fennel pollen maybe, some olive oil, a little sea salt. Absolutely fantastic
stuff.
Now,
you're eating them raw. You're not cooking them.
Absolutely raw. Okay. Absolutely raw. As little manipulation as possible. All these things need is for you to take the top off and put them in your mouth. Nothing but goodness.
Nothing but goodness. And so when we get these figs home, are we at all refrigerating them? Or how do we take care of them?
Depending on the ripeness level, you can usually tell. If you look at the underside of the fig and you can see the weightiness to the bottom, you can see if there's some honey-like liquid coming from the bottom. Those are the ones that you want to eat right away. The other ones, if they're a little firmer, pop them in the fridge. You can keep them at room temperature if you want to eat them within the next 24 hours.
Okay.
But this isn't something you want to sit on. You want to eat these right away.
Okay. And I noticed you told me you're buying a couple of cases of these figs. You're planning to kind of burn through those in just a couple days, right?
These are going to fly. These are going to fly. Absolutely.
Okay.
And they're better to use right away.
Okay. And so other varieties that are going to be coming now, they're very spotty. I mean, we have a flush of figs now. I think they bloom twice. There'll be a later crop.
Yes.
I don't know, end of August.
End of August, early September, you'll see another batch of, say, Black Missions, I think. But usually the Adriatics really are their best in the summertime. Another wonderful application of the fig tree itself is the leaves. The flavor of the fig leaf will impart a wonderful perfume to fish or meat or poultry. And if you blanch the leaf very quickly in boiling water, and then slice some fresh figs, maybe some halibut, wrap it in the fig leaf, tie it with twine, and pop it in the oven for about 30 minutes. Absolutely fantastic.
No additives, nothing else, just that.
Nothing.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that sounds great. Temperature of the oven, 350?
I'd say 350, 375.
Yeah. Oh, sounds good. Okay, thank you, Evan.
Wonderful.
That was Evan Funke. He's the executive chef at Rustic Canyon. He obviously is so happy summer is here, and he's just enjoying these figs, as should you. Another seasonal favorite that we love to enjoy when the summer gets here is melons. Ed Munak is here. He's from Paso Robles, and he is one of our premier melon farmers. Now, you've got two kinds of melons right now. I know everything is late. I know there's going to be more. Tell us what two kinds of melons you have and describe the color and flavor.
Okay, at this time we have a green flesh melon, which is a rocky sweet. And it is very sweet melon, and it's very refreshing, especially in a hot day, you know. And then we have a Charente, and we're surprised. They usually come much later in the season, but this year they're the early ones.
people think of a melon as being enormous. These are small enough. They're like a large grapefruit.
Come pretty
a little smaller.
Yeah.
So now the heat, now it's really heating up, and now they're really coming on fast.
Like 110 other day.
What does that do to the melon, though, that's sitting out there in the field? Does that ever get too
hot?
It makes
more sugar. Melons and tomatoes are the two fruit that really love a lot of heat. And the more heat they get, the more sugar they make.
Right. Now, am I going to take these home and put them in the fridge, or am I just going to eat them room temperature?
We tell them to leave it out until they're ready to eat it, then put it in and chill it for a little bit. That's the best way.
Just a little, just to get them a little chilled.
If you get them too cold, you can't taste it.
How do you tell when they're really ready to eat?
When the aroma is so overwhelming, you can't resist it anymore.
Okay. So no squeezing, no thumping, just smell it.
If you want to. Yeah. Some people push the flour in, and if it's softened a little bit, it's time. I mean, that's how I sell them.
That was Ed Munak, and he is a grower from Paso Robles, and he grows melons and tomatoes, which apparently love those super hot days and the cool nights where they can pick up sugar and flavor week after week. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Fig ideas from Evan Funke are on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Right now, you'll see tomatoes in abundance at the farmer's market. They're everywhere, including in pots in Good Food producer Harriet L.'s backyard. Back in May, Harriet confessed her past failure at growing tomatoes, her black thumb, so to speak. Now she's actually growing plants under the tutelage of Scott Digg, a landscaper who runs the annual Tomato Mania seedling sale.
Ladies and gentlemen, Harriet is growing tomatoes. there are tomatoes all over here. I'm in Ojai, so I'm cooler than you are here. And we haven't even, I picked one, one tomato. Forget, one plateful. We can talk about particulars because I know you're worried about a couple things. But on the whole, way to go.
So I, of course, the competitive side of me went over to Evan's house and saw her huge, gigantic trees with huge, lush, big leaves. And mine, they're kind of spindly. I've had to take off some of the leaves because they have this brown color to them.
They don't look like green and as thick as, some do and all that. Number one, it can be they're different tomatoes. So a lot of people fret about this. Mine doesn't look like my neighbor's, doesn't look like whatever. If they're different tomatoes, from the get-go mean you're going to have a very different animal, right? After that, it gets down to feeding, watering schedule, the soil mix, all that. Plus exposure. I remember you said you were worried about getting enough sun here. You're getting plenty of sun here. So part of what we might do here is even have you, as it gets warmer, have you move into the shade of this citrus tree just a little bit to get a little bit more, to not sort of have them in the sun for what is 12 hours a day. Don't need that. You need 6. 8's optimal.
I have a 4th of July, which is a standard hybrid, medium-sized red tomato. And a few weeks ago, I emailed you a picture of some of the leaves that were turning sort of a half brown. It wasn't like they were dry and burning up. It was more just like a discoloration. Mm-hmm. And you said I had blight. Now, what is that? You told me basically to take the leaves off, which I've done. So tell me what that is first.
Well, what's here looks good. Fungal diseases attack tomatoes. That's just what happens. Spores that are in the air, in the soil, whatever, attack. And it's a disease problem that hits us some years worse, some years we don't have as much, whatever it is. It can be several things. It's not like one thing gets tomatoes. And because I'm not like a garden perfectionist to the nth degree, I generally don't track that down on my own plants and go, oh my God, what have I got? We know it's a fungal disease. We treat, we remove the leaves, whatever you decide to do. And hopefully you move ahead. If you're feeding correctly, if you're watering correctly, and all things remain equal, nothing crazy, you don't have to be, do anything radically different, you should be able to, A, grow through that and produce through that, or B, lick the problem, one or the other. I say this all the time. If your plant turns brown and crunchy overnight, the entire thing, you got a real problem. If your leaves at the bottom especially are yellowing, you're seeing some browning, remove them. You have your, one thing I want to note here and see if I can describe for everybody is you have your tomatoes tied up very loosely, which means that they're very open. That affords more circulation, That's good. More air circulation, which could be helping in the fungal, you know, idea or with the fungal problem. But it also exposes the plant a lot more, which is why it may look a little less than, a little smaller and a little, like, more tough than maybe you saw on Evan's plants, right? That might be one of the reasons. We had some early, what I thought was, oh my, you know, gee, look out. And I think most of those are looking up now. If they were slow to start or they showed some signs, I've done a couple doses of compost tea, and they really seem to be happy for the most part. So I'm really pleased with that, and I would recommend that. If you haven't done that yet, that's one thing that we'll talk about today, is that mid-season here, as they're growing, a little pick-me-up, especially in containers. You need to be fertilizing every 10 days. Because now that it's warmer, we're watering more. As we water more, we're flushing the last application of fertilizer right out of the bottom of the pot. So again, a good compost tea is going to be great. At this point of the season, when they're fruiting and yours are going to town, be careful of what you apply. The fish emulsion in that can be a little too high in nitrogen. So apply something balanced, whether it's a liquid, whether it's a granular, whatever it is, just be consistent with it. Because here's the deal. You're getting tomatoes. Now what we're liable to do is go, and relax and, you know, put our feet up and go, wow, I'm done. Here I go for the season. Not happening. You have to stay on top of it. And you've got to maintain these plants and urge them to go through our long season, which can be November.
What do you think about the size of my pots? Not big enough?
The pots are perfect. 15 by 15. That's what we talk about as a minimum. You've done that and more with some of this. I think it's time again to look at, you have 3 to 4 inches from the top of the soil to the top of the pot. You know what? It's time for a good compost mix or worm castings or something great. Here it is. I mean, gosh, we're almost mid-season in some places. And you're well along in all your in all your fruiting. The plants are stressed. At this point, the plants are working really, really hard because you've got, I'm looking over here, you've got 25 fruits on this 4th of July. That's pretty amazing. So, when you apply a composting mix, you're mulching. So now you're protecting more. You're insulating some more, right? You're feeding to some degree. And you're just helping that plant along into the next phase of its life. You also, in this case, will be covering up some stem. That's cool. It's going to root. All that new root is new vigor.
So I have a lot of tomatoes on my counter, which you noted. And some of the 4th of July's that I've picked have a kind of that same sort of brown discoloration at the bottom of the fruit. Is that safe to eat, and what is that?
Oh, it's completely safe to eat. It's blossom end rot, and yours aren't showing as much as can show on a tomato. Often you'll have half of the tomato, and this generally happens early in the season. Half of the tomato will be brown, and that's because generally they said for eons, they've said it's because of a calcium deficiency. And you can always add calcium in eggshells or whatever, and lots of people do. But more often than not, and recently findings show that, you know, it's really about inconsistency. And we have that right now. I mean, look at the weather in the last 6 weeks. It's crazy, and the plant doesn't know what to do. It's too cool at night. It's warm or foggy all day or whatever it is. But when there's that inconsistency, the plant is almost aborting the fruit, pulling the calcium from the fruit, which causes a bruise on the back end or the blossom end. It's totally fine to eat. Cut that off. You're good to go. It's just not very pretty.
Okay, great. Well, I actually feel so much better. I was a little stressed out. I was thinking that there was all kinds of problems and diseases, but it seems like I'm doing okay.
Well, the bottom line is you have beautiful tomatoes on some good-sized plants. And you know what? What more can you ask for? For a first-timer, you've done very well.
Great. Thanks so much, Scott.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Scott Daig's tips for growing and maintaining tomato plants is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Scott's been helping Good Food producer Harriet Ells with her tomato plants.
You can go out to eat, yeah, that's for sure. But nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice now.
Every week, Jonathan Gold joins us here on Good Food. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly. Today, he's here to talk about a very special restaurant. One that's a little further afield.
To Copenhagen, to specifically a restaurant called Noma that a lot of people are saying is the best in the world at the moment.
You know, there's something about what this restaurant sounds like and how he talks about the food that to me just seems to be uniquely Scandinavian.
It is completely Scandinavian. And I've got to say, when I went to the restaurant, I was expecting to hate it. If you look at the cookbook, and it's beautiful, it's just one of the most gorgeous cookbooks ever done. It has pictures of tree bark and has pictures of exotic seaweeds and it has pictures of I don't know if it has pictures of moose tongue, but it's like it is pictures of moose tongue. You go through there and there's not half a dozen dishes that you can consider making in your house or that you even could.
It just seems that the Scandinavian cultural experience is so inflected with the relationship with the natural world.
Right. Although if you go to the better restaurants in Copenhagen or any of the restaurants in Copenhagen, you don't see it. I mean, it's meat and potatoes. It's a very meat and potatoes cuisine. But Redzepi, who had worked at El Bulli for several years and who had done long stage at French Laundry and had worked in Copenhagen restaurants, was given the opportunity, I think 8 years ago, to be a chef in this unique space. It was a building in a neighborhood near on the harbor.
Kind of seedy?
It had been seedy. It had the reputation for being seedy, although it's like everything in Copenhagen. It's very clean and tidy. And the building had literally been built as a whale blubber warehouse in the 1750s. And there was a project to remodel the building, you know, several years ago. And as sort of a center for Nordic culture in Copenhagen, Redzepi's mandate was to go in and do a restaurant that was dedicated to Nordic food. And apparently the first problem was that nobody had the slightest idea of what Nordic food was. So he and one of his partners, I guess, took a trip around the Nordic countries and tasted all kinds of things and ate all kinds of things that we probably shouldn't talk about on the air. And he came up with this way of looking at food that is quite different from, I think, what anybody else had done before. At Noma, it's almost discovering things. Things that maybe were eaten by people's great-grandparents, but certainly hadn't been eaten since the war. And presenting it in a way that is almost narrative. And the point of the narrative is foraging. When you're seated at the table, you know, this comfortable, you know, bent wood chairs, wood tables, looking out into the harbor, there's like reindeer skins draped over the back of the chairs. I mean, you'd expect nothing less. A lot of the food isn't even immediately recognizable as food. At one point, you're sitting, you've had a first course of an oyster or something, and you realize you're being expected to eat something, but you look around and it's like, okay, there's silverware, there's like a little vase on the table that has a spray of wildflowers, and there's gnarled twigs sticking up out of it. And eventually either you figure out or somebody come over to tell you that the twigs are made out of this special kind of rye made from island in the North Sea, and they're dusted with this green powder made from beech shoots, the shoots of beech and birch trees that have been dried and ground into a powder. And you pick them up and you munch them, and they're delicious.
Did you enjoy the meal?
I enjoyed the meal immensely. But it kept on going like this. The next one was this box that looked like, you know, a $200 botanical arrangement from a really expensive florist. And you're looking, and this time you realize there's something to eat on it. And it's like the pebbles sort of look like potatoes, but they're sea pebbles. And they're like moss. It looks like a putting green. And then you realize that this sort of thing that looks like a tumbleweed in the center is probably the edible thing. In fact, it is. It's like a kind of Icelandic seaweed that's baked and salted and herbed, and it's delicious. The course after that, they bring out a plate of empty mussel shells, all facing up, all beautifully arranged. Somewhere, you dig around and you find a mussel, and there's no utensils during most of this, and the mussel is delicious. And then you push the plate away a little, and the waiter comes over and looks at you and says, you know, you can eat the shell, you know. And so you dig back through and you find the slightly moist shell. And in fact, it's a flatbread that's been colored with squid ink to look exactly like a mussel shell. It's the most delicious cracker you've ever had. There's one course where they bring out a mason jar filled with crushed ice, and you open the lid, and there are two tiny living prawns inside. And you pick up the prawn, which immediately becomes very lively. It's tiny. It's almost transparent. And you pop it in your mouth, and there's just this amazing, fresh, vibrant, slightly salty animal flavor. I mean, you feel the thing die under your teeth. It's disconcerting, but this particular shrimp in this particular fjord apparently is the very first sign of spring. It's how you know that the hard winter is finally over. And it has a significance that even though it's not your culture and you've experienced the hard Nordic winter by, you know, sitting by the pool in Southern California, you understand how it fits in to the life cycle. I mean, let me describe a couple more of the dishes, if I could. There's one that I think is at the very center of what they're doing. Towards the end of service, a waiter brings out a big platter on which is piled damp hay. And on the damp hay is this sort of black steel plate that's heated very, very hot. And so it's smoldering. And so there's this perfume of, like, burning hay that goes through the room, and this sort of, like, trail that goes behind him, like a truck on the 405 that you wish would get his, certificate revoked. They bring it out to the table, and there is sort of an array of ingredients. There is a wild duck egg, and you squirt a little hay oil into the pan, and you crack the duck egg into the hay oil. They set a timer to go for exactly 2 minutes. When 2 minutes is up, you push the timer, then you put a little knob of goat butter into the pan, let it melt, and then pick up these leaves of ramps and of wild garlic and sauté them in the butter.
So you're doing all this yourself?
You're doing all this yourself. At what is apparently the 3 minute and 30 second mark, which they're also the timer's also going in the kitchen, somebody brings out a oil, like a ramsin oil, I think, and ladles a little bit of over the egg. And then there's a handful of these beautiful flowering herbs, like just tiny, tiny herbs that you pick up and you strew over the dish. You've cooked your own egg. I mean, you've cooked your own dish. But everything has been done for you. Everything has been made possible so that you're eating the best egg in the world. But you have done it, and you have involvement in the dish, and you have, you know, smelled the ingredients, looked at them, maybe nibbled a little bit of them raw, and seen what the herbs were, and it's yours. It belongs to you in a way. And of course it doesn't. I mean, it's his dish, but you feel as if it's yours. And it's beautiful.
Wow. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Gold about Noma in Copenhagen, considered the best restaurant in the world. If you're disappointed that Jonathan isn't recommending something a little closer to home, don't despair. This week, I'm pulling a recommendation from our archives. It's Chunjuhan Il Kwan in Koreatown, serving a hearty bowl of Buddha Jjigae, or spam stew. Get the address sent to your cell phone by texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. For a complete list of all of Jonathan's recommendations, just check out the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Leslie Ball has been writing about food and drink in L.A. for over 10 years. Her blog is chowballa.com. And this month, she contributed to Angelino Magazine for their annual restaurant issue.
I think what's going on right now is really super exciting. I think we probably, as food writers, we probably say that every year, especially in the media, because we have to. We're always making lists. We're always looking at what happened over the course of the last year. In fact, the snapshot that I got, once we narrowed down this list of the 10 awards and who exactly we wanted to put in the awards, and we looked at the shortlist, and all I could see was a lot of rising stars, a lot of young chefs doing really interesting things.
So who are these rising stars?
Well, I think one great person to start with is Jordan Kahn from Red Medicine. And the funny thing about Jordan, so I was first introduced to him. Most L.A. diners were at 14. He is actually a trained pastry chef. He worked with Michael Mina. He worked at the French Laundry. He's a fantastic pastry chef. Now, at 14, he had this very conceptual way of approaching his ingredients and dishes. And there was one dessert at 14 that people either loved or hated. And it was this white cube with about 12 different ingredients inside. And you broke into it and all these layers and textures and colors. And I hated it. Didn't like it at all. So then when I heard he's about to open a restaurant with Southeast Asian flavors, so Vietnamese flavors, and with the guy from Umami Burger, and it just all made me think, I'm not going to like this. And then I went, and I loved it. I loved everything about this restaurant. I loved the bar. I loved the food. I loved the space. One of the dishes that I thought was great, well, there were a couple things. He did these two versions of banh mi. I happened to be there when he changes the menu all the time. But one was a traditional banh mi that's on a bar menu. And then he had one in the restaurant. And it was these like very thin, crisp pieces of bread that were toasted. And in between them, sandwiched between them, were, you know, a piece of country pate and some pickles and just garnished sort of on top. And it was just these beautiful little 3-inch long appetizers, basically these bites of food. And they were just gorgeous. And you look at it next to this banh mi and the flavors were there. It's just, you know, that really fun way of taking something and it doesn't look the way you think it should look, but it tastes the way you imagine it should taste. He's a very talented young chef, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what else he's going to do.
Who else would you like to talk about?
Yeah. So what I chose as best new restaurant was A-Frame, which is Roy Choi's restaurant in Culver City on Washington Boulevard. I thought this might be a little controversial. I thought people might agree with this or not agree with this. And I fully stand behind this pick because when I was thinking about what makes a best new restaurant, you know, it's service, it's style, it's vibe, it's food, but it's also where do you want to go to eat all the time? And I was talking to a lot of people over the last couple of months, and a lot of people just kept saying, I always want to go to A-Frame. I'm there twice a week. I'm there a few times a month. That makes a great restaurant. I mean, that to me is what it's all about. So there, you know, Roy Choi, Kogi fame, has this full menu. It's sit down. It's lively and it's super communal. I know the last time I went with one other person and we had to share a table with two strangers and it didn't matter. And, you know, we were ripping apart chicken, this amazing beer can chicken that he makes there, and this popcorn, this kettle corn popcorn that he makes with corn pops and seaweed and dried pineapple and garlic. And it's the most addictive thing ever. You really get a sense of who he is from his menu. When you're eating the food, how the place feels. It's loud. You can't hear anybody. They don't take reservations. You have to wait for a table. And it's fun. And it's a place that I would always want to go.
Let's pick a couple more.
Okay. So another fun one was picking best new mixologist. I went with Julian Cox. And there's a good reason. So he started with John Sedler at Rivera. And now he's at Playa with John Sedler. But he did Test Kitchen all of last year. He was the main. He helped every chef that rolled into that testing ground and paired cocktails with their menus. And every time they were different and unique and these great spirits. And at Playa recently, I had this really fantastic cocktail called a beer in a ball. And he kind of chuckled when I ordered it because it says hops infused champagne on the menu. It's Miller High Life. It's one of the funniest things, and I'll tell you what, it's Aperol and Campari and Miller High Life and grapefruit juice, and it is so refreshing, and it's just really, it's just so clever. And speaking of Soto, for best new dish from a new restaurant this year, I picked their porchetta, which is a rolled pork belly, seasoned, slow roasted. They slice it thick. They serve it with greens. Simple. They do this once a week. It's a special on Sundays, and then you can also get it during lunch. They serve it on this amazing house-made bread that they make. It's kind of a sourdough, artisan, rustic bread. just simple and fabulous. Another restaurant that I love to talk about is Lakshan. Sangyun's restaurant, we picked for best design because it's gorgeous, but it's also like this is a place where you just want to go and eat. The bar is amazing. The seats are comfortable. Everything's so subtly designed that it's so perfect and just beautiful. And then another place, speaking of atmosphere, is I don't know, it's a place that maybe not a lot of people have gone. It's called Everly. It's on Sunset Strip near Red Rock, like on that end, across the street from Il Soleil. When you walk into this place, you're on the Sunset Strip, but you walk in and it is so gorgeous, these weathered woods, and you walk through this small room, like a front room where there's a bar and a small dining room with a fireplace, and they built this big patio on the back, and they lift up the shades, and it's all open, but there are sort of walls around you, and you just look down the hillside, and it's very pastoral. They have plants and trees all around the sides. And really, the food's quite good. They have a great cocktail program. I just love it because you just don't feel like you are where you are. It feels like you should be out in Topanga or something like that.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
Leslie Bala is a food writer in Los Angeles. Her blog is called Chow Bala, CHOW.com. Leslie worked on Angeleno Magazine's annual restaurant awards. Find her picks at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, was Julia Child really a spy? I've got the answer for you in just 1 minute, plus what Chilis are telling us about global warming. Stay tuned. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Julia, that one named lady, of course I'm talking about Julia Child, the one that we all love and are fascinated by. And part of that fascination is that her culinary coming of age happened relatively late. She had a whole life before those faded cooking classes in Paris. There were rumors for years that Julia Child was a spy, that she worked for the OSS. Well, Jeanette Conant gives us the real story, more dramatic than we could ever imagine, of the deepening friendship of Julia and Paul Child, set against the fractures of American political and cultural life as they meet in the OSS during World War II. Her book is A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. Jeanette, could you describe Julia as she was when she first volunteered for the OSS?
Yes, she was very different than the Julia Child that most people think of today. She was really a rather awkward, insecure, inexperienced 30-year-old. She was single. She was unemployed. And she had a series of failed career attempts behind her. So she was a little bit lost.
And her background, what did she come from?
Well, she was from a well-to-do California family. She was raised in Pasadena. Her father was a wealthy rancher, and she had gone to Smith College. And after college, she really had devoted her years, as she put it, to being a social butterfly. They belonged to the local country club. She played a lot of tennis and golf. She was very athletic. But as she put it, she sort of wasted her post-college years. She was very unfocused. She went to a lot of parties. She was really supposed to get married to the boy next door. And oddly enough, when he proposed, she turned him down. She wanted to do something with her life. She said in her diary that she was a big girl. She sort of felt she had a big destiny ahead of herself. And when it failed to materialize, she was a bit disappointed.
What was it about young women like this that made them attractive to the OSS?
Well, the OSS was our first attempt at a foreign intelligence agency, and it was very hastily organized in the early days of the war. And so they needed to recruit a lot of people very, very quickly, and they needed smart people who were well-educated, but didn't necessarily have a background in espionage. I mean, very few people really did, and the people who did were already working for the Army and Navy intelligence. So they cast a rather wide net. They hired a lot of people from the Ivy League, and the joke went also from the Junior League. You know, women that were well-educated, had gone to sort of the Seven Sisters colleges, that could type, and had enough wealth and sophistication that they were used to travel, were independent. William Donovan, who headed the OSS, felt also that if you had private money, you were less easily bribed, which was very important for an intelligence service. So Julia was like a lot of the sort of well-to-do, well-educated young girls that flocked to Washington and were recruited by the OSS.
So when she first entered, what was her job?
She first entered at the lowest level. She entered in a secretarial capacity in William Donovan's office. But she quickly got assigned to one of the very sort of odd research projects that the OSS funded, and it was called the Emergency Rescue Operation. And she was helping to develop a shark repellent for pilots who had been shot down at sea. And she loved her work, and she worked with a whole team. It was headed by an eminent Harvard zoologist, and she loved it. There was a very eccentric, brilliant group of people that were working on these rescue kits for pilots, and she felt that her work was really contributing something to the war effort.
And Paul, what was he doing there?
Well, Paul Child was a very odd character to be working at the OSS. He was an artist, sort of self-trained. He was a sculptor. He'd lived in Paris for years. But he was very, very good at design, and he was recruited to build war rooms for the Allied generals. You know, he could make detailed topographical maps out of modeling clay and very, very sophisticated diagrams. And so he was very, very good at it, and that's what he was doing for the OSS when she met him.
So what was her first foreign posting?
Her first foreign posting was in Ceylon, India. She was meant to go to New Delhi. She was very excited about sort of romantic visions of wartime India. And then her travel orders were rerouted to Ceylon, and she ended up in an absolutely beautiful, very remote tea planter's oasis up in the hills of Indonesia, of Ceylon, and it was called Kandy. And it was absolutely picture perfect, but very remote. And she had almost a year there. She ran what was called the OSS Registry. It was really the whole operations nerve center, and it contained all of the most classified documents. You know, the cables from the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, the code books, the locations of all the different OSS intelligence bases around the world, the names and aliases of their various agents operating behind enemy lines. It was really came with very grave responsibilities. She decoded many of the messages herself. She saw eyes-only invasion plans. She held the keys to the safe for the code books. She was somebody who was seen as absolutely discreet, absolutely trustworthy, and it was really quite an important job.
War is always an intense and transformative experience for those who experience it. How did her OSS experience during the war transform her?
Well, as Julia always used to say, the war made me. You know, she had been so sheltered in Pasadena, she'd never been further outside the country than Tijuana. By going to the OSS, she went to Ceylon, she went to India, she went to China. She really lived in these countries. She ate all the local cuisine. She came to know the people, the cultures, and she just loved it. And she discovered that this was really her milieu, that she loved these experiences, these foreign cuisines and tastes and flavors. And she didn't want to return to what she saw as really kind of her hayseed existence in the countryside in California. So if it hadn't been for the OSS, Julia never would have known about all of that and never would have been able to launch herself out of California into what would eventually be her whole sort of French chef life.
Thank you so much, Jeanette.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Jeanette Conant. Her book is A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. We'll have a link to it at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood.
–
I'm sure you've noticed that there is a huge renaissance in canning. And one of our great gurus here in Los Angeles is a gentleman named Ernest Miller. Ernie's the executive chef at The Farmer's Kitchen, which is that wonderful project from CLA, which also brings us the Hollywood Farmer's Market. Ernie's a master food preserver, and he's an instructor for the UC Cooperative Extension new master food preserver project. So great to have you here.
Thank you, Evan. It's wonderful to be here.
Many of us have heard about the Master Gardener program that UC Extension runs, and I understand that the Master Food Preservation Project is back on track for the first time in many, many years.
Absolutely. Both these programs go back to right after World War I to the Depression era, in which the UC Extensions tried to teach farmers how to grow better food and teach their wives how to preserve it. However, in the late 80s, early 90s, the Master Food Preserver program, people lost interest, budget cuts, and it went away. However, with this resurgence of interest, now we have these two wonderful programs that are very complementary. We teach you how to grow the food, and then we teach you how to preserve the food and take advantage of the bounty.
How difficult is it to get into the program?
Right now, it's actually very difficult. We have just started accepting applications for our Master Food Preserver certification program that starts in September and runs for 12 weeks. Unfortunately, we have a very limited number of spots because the class has to be very hands-on and a lot of people involved. Last time, we had almost four times as many people apply for the program as we could accept. And we're expecting to see that or even more for the second class. So it is difficult to get into.
And it's a real commitment of time. It's not something that someone can just say, oh, I want to go to this class for a couple of hours and then I'll be certified as a master preserver.
Oh, no, absolutely not. It's 12 weeks of classes, 4 hours for each class. But the most important thing to us is that, you know, this class is quite a bargain. It's $120 for these 12 classes with the books and all the product that you'll be receiving. But we expect you to pay it back in volunteer hours, that you'll go out into the community, work with community gardens, low-resource neighborhoods, senior housing projects, and teach what you've learned, teach other people how to safely preserve food.
And I understand that you're going to be quite a presence at the upcoming Eat Real Festival.
Absolutely. It's kind of like the coming out for the Master Food Preservers. The class graduated June 20th, and we're going to be doing a crowdathon at the Eat Real Festival where people can come by and we're going to, you know, help you, you know, show you to chop the cabbage, add the salt and flavorings and how to make sauerkraut, which is one of my favorite things.
I'm actually going to be at Eat Real, too, and I'm going to be doing a tomato demo.
There's so much to do with tomatoes.
So let's talk a little bit about all the different things that you can do with a tomato. Tomato paste, how do you go about doing it the proper way?
Well, basically, you're going to be pureeing or milling the tomatoes and creating a very loose sauce. There's going to be a lot of juice in tomatoes, especially, you know, the height of season. The tomatoes are just full of wonderful juice. You're going to want to extract that juice as much as possible and then cook down the remainder very slow. And there's several different ways of doing it until you get to that thick, luscious paste that becomes, you know, that secret ingredient and just gives much wonderful flavor to so many different dishes.
And when you make your own, it's a revelation. I mean, you could just take it and put it on bread with olive oil. It's so delicious. Something you wouldn't think of doing necessarily with the canned variety.
Oh, absolutely. And when you're doing it with, you know, farmers market produce, those tomatoes have so much flavor and so much wonderful things. And, of course, you could do fun things and just use all green zebra tomatoes and make green tomato paste. And, you know, just absolutely delicious.
The last time I was taking a class with you, you mentioned that you actually make yogurt roll-ups in your dehydrator.
Yes. And it's a very simple recipe. I use two parts yogurt and one part of one of my homemade jams. I blend them in a blender. Then I spread them out on leather drying sheets for my dehydrator. And my nephews and nieces call it candy. You know, it's you know, wonderful flavor, you know where it's coming from, and everybody loves it.
And you don't have to worry about this dairy product being dried?
Well, there's a couple of things on that. One, the yogurt that you should use will be a non-fat yogurt because fat has a tendency to go rancid. However, even if you use that, if you eat it within a week or so, it'll be fine. But without, if you use a non-fat yogurt, then it should last a month under, nice dry conditions in a sealed jar or something.
What are you excited that's in the market that you see right in front of your door at Farmer Kitchen that you're looking forward to putting up for yourself?
Well, stone fruit, plums, apricots, nectarines, and there's so many different things. Just in the past week, I've put up a nectarine chutney, a peach salsa, apricot butter using organic Blenheims, and then, you know, plain organic jam. And right now in my kitchen, I've got some sour plum juice that I'll be turning into a sour plum jelly today.
Wow. Sour plum jelly. That would be incredible. I mean, that would be really great served with meat, served with cheese.
Absolutely. I've never actually made it before, but I'm thinking that the tartness of the plums is going to match very well with the large amount of sugar you have to use in the jelly and give a very balanced, something that can go both sweet and savory.
Well, I look forward to seeing you at Eat Real.
Likewise.
Maybe we'll trade. I'll trade you some preserves for kraut.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Ernie.
It's been my pleasure.
Ernest Miller's the executive chef at the Farmer's Kitchen, and he's the instructor at the UC Cooperative Extension's Master Food Preserver Program. Ernie's also going to be on stage at the Eat Real Fest next weekend in Culver City. It's a two-day-long event celebrating everything local, artisanal, and delicious. You'll find Ernie on the Food Crafters stage. I'll be there, too, giving a tomato sauce demonstration. A link to info and a schedule of events for Eat Real is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, what chilies are telling us about climate change and how to cure meat at home. This is Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. I'll be right back. There's lots of talk about how climate change is affecting the weather and sea levels, but one of the most profound results of climate change will be how it will affect agriculture. A trio of very smart men, one an ethnobotanist, another an agroecologist, and the third a chef, decided to use one plant, the chili, as an example of how climate change will affect our food system. The ethnobotanist and prolific writer of books is Gary Paul Nabhan. He's here with us today. Now, you decided instead of taking this enormous subject and trying to get your hands around the unwieldiness of how big it is, you decided to pick one plant, the chili. Why did you decide to choose that particular plant as an example of these changes?
Well, chilies are very interesting. They're worldwide. They're our most important spice and condiment crop, period. But at the same time, the varieties, or at least many of the varieties, are place-based. They're specific to one kind of geography, soil, and climate. So that we wanted to look at a universal crop that had very specific adaptations to place that are now being reshuffled as climate change affects the interactions between soil and climate and culture and water. We went to the places that have the rarest, most celebrated chilies in their region. So the datil pepper in Florida is just grown in a two-county area, and people hardly know of it outside of Florida. The same thing with the fish pepper in the Baltimore to Philadelphia area near Chesapeake Bay. And why we did that is that if we're going to lose food biodiversity in the next few decades because of climate change, it's probably these narrowly restricted, rare heirloom varieties that are most likely to blink out.
When I imagine chilies being grown for the commercial market, I imagine just acres and acres of plants in, like, Arizona with tons of fruit on them.
And that perception is correct. In southern Arizona, where I live, over to El Paso, Texas, and Las Cruces, New Mexico, we grow thousands of acres of chilies for canning and for stuffing and for making into salsas. And those chilies are having a fairly tough time. They require a lot of water, and we're suffering a decade of water scarcity here. And we're subject to a lot of introduced diseases like viruses that plants growing in open sunlight and hot temperatures are particularly vulnerable to. And the most dramatic thing that farmers told us is it's not the heat or the drought per se that is affecting them the most, but the new introduced diseases, pests, and weeds.
So are farmers experimenting with protecting these plants now by starting to grow shade trees?
That's the great thing about the farmers that we met. They're not passive victims of climate change. They don't feel that there's this fatalistic course that they're on where eventually climate change is going to drive them out of business. They're doing as much improvisation as a good jazz musician would do. Some are planting chilies under the shade of citrus trees in northern Mexico. A farmer at Isleta Pueblo is growing them in the shade of cottonwood trees that grow on his riverbank. And many farmers are buffering themselves from drought and water scarcity by increasing the soil moisture-holding capacity of their field soils. So that if farmers can increase that as much as 50-fold, you have that much more water retention. Whether they get 2 or 3 inches of rain less than the year before doesn't matter as much as it would if they hadn't created that extra sponge in the soil.
Do you foresee a time where chili farmers will move to northern states?
I think that's already happening to some extent. We're seeing that those bands of latitude that were in the paths of certain storm fronts are already shifting as ocean currents change their trajectories and move further away or closer to the coast. We're seeing that the continental storm patterns are shifting to some extent, and that's why we're getting this climatic uncertainty, some places drowning out, other places flooding.
So interesting. Have we lost many of these wild species to climate change that you know of?
We're seeing dramatic changes in the populations of these chilies. It may mean that some populations blink out. And again, we can't say that a 50-year-old freeze event is due to climate change. We can't ever say Hurricane Rita or Hurricane Katrina or the Great Freeze of 2011 is due to climate change, because individual events can't be associated that well with the trends. But nevertheless, they're giving us a notion of what we're going to be facing with greater frequency over the next 3 decades.
Gary Paul Nobben is an award-winning author, plant conservationist, and sustainable agriculture advocate. His new book is Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. Charcuterie, or cured meats. It seems like we're in a golden age of artisanal product these days. Chef John Kowalski is a professor of culinary arts at the Culinary Institute of America, the other CIA. He's also the co-author, along with the Institute, of The Art of Charcuterie. Could you actually sort of formally define what charcuterie is?
Yeah, charcuterie, going back to long years, but with the Greeks and Romans and so forth, they were making charcuteries. Basically, what they needed to do is especially from November to about March or so, they needed to rely on food products, and they couldn't go outside to get anything. So they had to, when they fabricated, let's say, the hog or the beef product, they couldn't eat it all at the same time. So they needed to transform it into other products that could be held a fair amount of time, and then, of course, they can enjoy some different variety in their life.
Now, there's a type of mixture that is talked about quite a bit in books, which a lot of people don't understand, and that is force meat. Could you describe what it is?
Yeah, force meat could be various different kind of items, but basically, if you think of a meatloaf at home, what do you have in that meatloaf? You usually have a type of meat, which has been ground or cut and mixed. You have a binder, like maybe bread crumbs soaked in cream or milk a little bit, or some people might use potato chips or saltine crackers, whatever, but some sort of starchy product, possibly an egg, and different seasoning and flavoring, and all that is mixed together, so it forms this tacky kind of mixture like when you make meatballs. That mixture is known as the force meat.
And what is it used as a base for?
Well, the force meats could be used, and depends how you put them together. One, force meats could be used for pâtés or terrines or galantines. So let's say we want to make a duck force meat for a duck terrine. So we would maybe take duck legs and thighs. We would cube them, clean them of all the sinew. Maybe we would put a little bit of fat in there, whether it's duck fat or pork fat. We maybe put some thyme, a little bit of rosemary, salt and pepper, some poultry seasonings, maybe a little sauté shallots in there, a little brandy. And we would macerate that or let that marinate, let's say, overnight to pick up some flavors. The next day, we would grind all those things together.
And then it's also used in sausages, right?
Right. And sausages, it's pretty much the same thing. Now we look at when we do sausages, we would say maybe it's a 80-20 mix or 70-30 mix, meaning 70% meat, lean meat, cubed, of course, clean, and then 30% would be a fat product, and then seasoning and so forth. Now, here in sausages, we no longer use things like heavy cream, bread, and eggs to hold it together, but we use other things like non-fat dry milk powder, like maybe a phosphate, things of that nature, so that helps to hold it together a little bit.
What should home cooks know about the risks of preparing charcuterie at home, and how do we keep ourselves properly sanitized?
Well, sanitation is very important. Everything's have to be very clean. You should wash your hands, of course, before going to grind, making sure that the machinery is always very clean and very cold to keep the meat sanitary. Now, other things, you know, certain people might be wary of nitrate, nitrite use, other chemicals, but we try to do minimal amount of use of those chemicals. I think you can use a lot of things that you can make and preserve them. If you use the correct amount of salt for the correct amount of time, it will not taste salty, but it will draw enough moisture out of the product so that bacteria does not survive in there.
This has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan. It's been a pleasure.
Chef John Kowalski is a professor of culinary arts at the Culinary Institute of America. He's the co-author of The Art of Charcuterie. A recipe for country-style forcemeat is at kcrw.com/goodfood. John also explained to me how to cure fish. The audio's on the Good Food blog. Check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, you can download the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood or from iTunes. You can also hear the show on the KCRW app for the iPhone or Android. And I hope to see you next weekend at the Eat Real Festival at Helms Bakery. Look for me next to that huge vat of tomato sauce. Harriet Ells produced and edited today's program with Julian Ferguson. Candace Moyer and Lyra Garcia are our segment producers. Thanks to Roddy Mickelson, Gary Masiha, and Taryn Olson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.